Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. On this week's program, I have two guests with me to discuss the issue of domestic violence. Heather Campbell has a master's in social work from Binghamton University. She has been an advocate, activist, and educator who has worked at Ithaca's Advocacy Center for over 12 years. From 1997 to 2000, she was the domestic violence counselor and advocate and is currently the education director. She is also a founding member of the New York State LGBTQ Domestic Violence Network. And my other guest, who has asked me to use her first name only, is Christy. Christy is in her early 30s and is a native of the Finger Lakes region. She is a survivor of violence from a former boyfriend, and she's here to share her story with us. Thank you both for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, Heather, I want to begin with you. You've worked in this arena of domestic violence for over 12 years. What is it that got you involved in these issues?
Well, I was really always interested in what I used to think of really more broadly as women's issues, and interested in the issue of advocacy, and thought I was one of those people who thought they were going to be a lawyer.
Oh.
And really realized through an internship at a rape crisis program when I was in college that it was the advocacy part of the law that interested me, not necessarily the law.
Uh-huh.
And so I started volunteering at a rape crisis program, and then volunteering at the agency that I now work for as a volunteer hotline advocate. And I think that there are many people who end up working professionally in my field who start out as a volunteer. There's a real grassroots volunteer connection to the violence against women movement.
Yeah, there
and,
is.
And really, I have a deep personal commitment. I've had friends, family, people I care about who've been impacted by violence. And so that personal commitment has really become a very professional commitment for me.
Uh-huh. And it sounds like you wanted to work with people rather than the intellectual pursuit of the law.
I did. And I think that the other thing that's interesting me more and more as I move through my career is really looking at how does our community respond to issues of violence, not just on an individual level, but as a community, how are we responding to the issues of violence and how are we working to prevent violence in the future?
Well, let's hone in on the issue of domestic violence. It crosses class, color, economic, age, demographics. To tell us a little bit about it, from your perspective, no one is immune.
No, and I think that's one of the most pervasive myths still in our culture about domestic violence is that people just don't have that awareness that domestic violence happens in all communities, to all kinds of families, to all kinds of relationships. Really the most common risk factor for domestic violence is being female in our culture.
Mm.
We know that women are disproportionately impacted by violence. We also know that men are experience violence in relationships as well, and that's important to acknowledge. But we know from the research that about 85 to 90% of the victims of domestic violence in our community are female.
Mm-hmm.
When we look at all of those other things that make us different, race, class, level of education, whether we live in a big city or a rural community, domestic violence happens in about one out of every three relationships.
That's amazing, isn't it?
It is. And sometimes people will say to me, well, I don't know that statistic can be true because I don't know anyone who's ever experienced that.
Really?
But the reality is that we all probably do.
Mm-hmm.
That there's still tremendous silence and embarrassment that many survivors feel and a sense of isolation. I often talk to survivors who say, I thought I was the only person who had experienced this or was feeling this. So I think another really important task that we have, both as individuals and as a community, is to continue to break that silence and to allow opportunities and have space for people to tell the stories of what's happened in their lives and how the violence has impacted them and
yeah.
how they've survived, because
uh-huh.
that part of the story is really important as well.
It is indeed. Now, many people think physical assault when they think domestic violence, but in reality, emotional and psychological battering is just as horrible and probably even more long-lasting.
It can be, and not wanting to minimize physical danger, because we know that there are people who are experiencing tremendous physical harm and physical danger. But I think we really often minimize the impact of non-physical forms of abuse,
mm-hmm.
of verbal abuse, coercion, manipulation, threats.
And what you were talking about before, isolation.
Absolutely, and isolation. And I think it's important that we don't minimize. I know that myself as an advocate and the colleagues I work with, we often get calls on our 24-hour hotline from people saying, well, I don't think I'm calling the right place because I'm not getting hit, but...
Mm.
And then they go on to describe a really broad and scary pattern of things that are going on in their life. I think it's important that we have a definition of domestic violence that includes non-physical forms of abuse, and that really we're talking about one person using power to control their partner or former partner. And there's lots of different forms of power, unfortunately, that people can use if they're trying to get control over someone they're in a relationship with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that one hears about all the time is isolating a woman from her friends. And stalking her and calling her to see where she is.
There's isolation that's physically cutting people off from their supports, limiting their access to the phone, limiting their access to transportation. But there's also real emotional isolation and control, undermining relationships with others, making someone feel like you're the only person that's there for them, mm-hmm. but then undermining that by doing things that are hurtful and harmful, that really erode someone's sense of self and sense of safety. Mm-hmm. So I think sometimes for survivors, breaking that isolation can be the first step to reaching out for support, of being able to reach out and talk to other people and even connect with other people. That's what we often hear from women who come to our support groups, is that what can be helpful is being able to talk about what's going on and also recognizing that you're not the only one experiencing this and that you're not alone.
Indeed, yes. Now, there's much more to discuss on this issue, but I want to bring Christy into the conversation. Christy, thank you so much for being willing to tell your story.
Thank you for having me.
And let's begin with... You were abused by a boyfriend who you were with for 14 months. Tell us how you met and how it was in the beginning and when this abuse started.
We actually met through my ex-fiance. They had grown up together, and so we kind of knew each other, hit it off right away, and we just started dating. And everything was very nice and sweet, and we had the whole honeymoon period. He was very charming. And, you know, knew all of the right things to say and do. And at the time, I wasn't looking to become involved in a relationship, and he wasn't either, so dating was fine. And then things began to become more serious. And at that point, when we decided that we were going to be in an exclusive relationship, that is when he became very controlling and very manipulative, and it started out as the verbal and the mental abuse and that type of controlling. And it wasn't...
Did this start when you started living together? You mentioned...
The physical abuse mm-hmm. came after we moved in together.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't experienced that before. I had, in past relationships, experienced emotional abuse and manipulation. However, I had never dealt with that sort of physical abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't, like I said, it wasn't until we had moved in together and he had that sort of one-up on me and that power, and things just began to escalate from there.
Mm-hmm. And did the stereotype sorts of issues start coming up, telling you who to see and calling you and stalking you and making sure you were where you said you'd be? And did that start up as well?
Definitely. He would call me at work several times a day. He would call managers at work to make sure that I was there. Mind you, he didn't have a job,
mm-hmm.
But he didn't want me to go to work, but he did. So there was quite a conflict there. He would take my keys, make it very difficult for me at times to go to work. But then the stalking, he was a big fan of, you know, either following me, showing up at my work, showing up at my apartment. He would climb up on my second floor balcony, try to break into my apartment.
So this was before you were living together, huh?
Oh, well, there was a period of time when we had split up,
mm-hmm.
and I had kicked him out of the apartment. And during that period of time, he would come by my apartment constantly mm-hmm. and try to break in.
What did you finally do to get out of this? Did you start enlisting people at your place of work to tell him that he wasn't welcome? Or how did you deal with it?
I did talk to people at work, and he wasn't allowed on the premises. He did manage to sneak in the building a couple of times.
What would he do?
He would come up and just kind of surprise me and act like it was just a surprise, but it was because there was a trust issue there. I mean, there was no reason for him to show up at my place of employment. That's
mm-hmm.
my job.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually I ended up quitting my job because I couldn't take any of it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't take it.
And so what did you do? How did you finally extract yourself from this totally?
Well, I had discovered that he had, in fact, been cheating on me with several people. His best friend actually called to tell me that he was cheating on me, and he was sick of seeing me hurt, and he was sick of the lies and sick of covering up for him. And so he came, you know, through and told me a whole bunch of information, and I followed up on the information, and I said, that's it, I'm done. And I had a hunch that he was being unfaithful, but I didn't have any proof.
Mm.
And once I had proof, then I moved forward. And I waited till he was actually about to leave town to break things off. And he was just about to get on the airplane to leave town. And once I finally told him, I was like, listen, we're done. Of course, when he got back into town, he tried to contact me, and we had talked. We ended up running into each other, and he wanted to talk, and we were both intoxicated, and I said, okay, you know, I'll go with you. We'll talk. I had friends follow us, and he took off in his car. One thing led to another, and he just proceeded to beat the crap out of me while he was driving his vehicle down the road at 80 miles an hour.
My goodness. So you're lucky that you got out of this alive.
Yes, ma'am. I had to jump out of the vehicle in an intersection and run across lanes of traffic.
To save yourself. And so you finally probably pressed charges and got a restraining order. And
yep. I had filed charges. I filed for a restraining order. And I never would have thought that I would have been in that position. And in my heart, I knew if I didn't press charges, I was afraid I would go back to him. So that was kind of my deciding factor as to I need to press charges in order to get out of this relationship, because I was really afraid I would go back into it.
And did this relationship change you incredibly?
Very much. I've been single for 2.5 years. I deal with a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder. I have flashbacks. Every time I see his vehicle or his type of vehicle, I have panic attacks. So it's something that affects me on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. And did you have to rebuild your self-esteem?
Definitely. Once he finally pled guilty, and he got a reduced sentence as a result of pleading guilty. He didn't serve any jail time. He received 2 years probation. He was required to do a mandatory class for anger management, domestic violence, and drug abuse. And then he pretty much just got a slap on the wrist.
But you got out of it, and that's...
I did.
That's the main part of the story that we are totally delighted to know about. Now, Heather, talk to us more about the issue. How can a woman extract herself from this? What is the first thing that she should probably do?
Well, I think that for anyone who is living with or has been in a relationship with someone who's been abusive to them, one of the first things that our advocates will do is do a safety assessment. So it's really first looking at what are the things that survivors can do to better plan for their safety. So it's looking at what are the things that the survivor has some control over, having a safety plan about how they can get out if they need to, knowing who they can call, having important papers or things that they would need if they needed to leave quickly. So thinking about some of that safety planning it can be really helpful for many people. But I think reaching out for that support, knowing some people find that support from friends and family. Some people find that support from a place like the Advocacy Center, from a local domestic violence program. And there are programs all across the country, all across New York State, that are providing support that people can call anonymously. People can call 24 hours a day on the hotlines. And reaching out and finding out what are my options, what are the resources available, and getting that support. This is a hard thing to go through alone. And there are people who are out there who can help, and I think that's important for people to know.
Luckily, we do have the advocacy centers, because what we were talking about earlier, a lot of women end up being totally isolated and losing their friendships and losing their social networks. So sometimes somebody from the advocacy centers around the country is the only person who can help.
And also having specialized information about how to navigate the legal system. What are the options for getting an order of protection? What does it mean if there's an order of protection or a restraining order? Having that kind of specialized knowledge can really help people plan for safety.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Heather Campbell and Christy. We're talking about the subject of domestic violence. Now, we hear about women having low self-esteem who often stay in these abusive relationships. Now, do they often start out with low self-esteem, or does that happen as a result of these relationships and being beaten down year after year, month, however long?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. It's a question I'm often asked. And there's some interesting studies on that have looked at women who are in, looked at women over time. And so tracked women maybe before they were in that relationship and then after they were in a relationship that was abusive. And what we really think is that the experience of being abused is what impacts people's self-esteem or sense of self. Mm-hmm. Also increased rates of anxiety and depression. But that as a whole, women who are abused by their partners are not necessarily more or less depressed or have lower or higher self-esteem than the general population, but that experience of being abused has really significant emotional and psychological impacts. And that also that when women find safety, when they're able to separate from that abusive partner, that healing is really possible and that there can be long-term impacts. And I don't want to minimize that impact that people experience, but that healing is possible.
Christy, did you feel like you had low self-esteem prior to this relationship, or did it happen as a result of being treated so poorly?
I think that I've gone through fluctuations, having higher self-esteem and lower self-esteem at times. However, for the most part, I've always been a very confident woman. Growing up, I've been a dancer. I'm a performer. That's what I do. I get on stage and I shine. Mm-hmm. And being in this relationship, I felt beat down to nothing, to where I had absolutely no self-esteem. And as I left the relationship, I barely had a will to live.
Really? Really?
Mm-hmm.
And do you think you would have left this relationship if it hadn't been for the fact that you found out he was cheating? Do you think you were ready to leave because of the abuse just solely?
There was a lot of issues that were going on, and I was ready to leave, but I wasn't ready to leave.
Mm-hmm.
Part of me felt like I was, but for whatever reason, I still felt that attachment, and that he had me so manipulated that I really felt that I needed him.
Mm.
And in my particular case, I was 1,600 miles away from home. My family wasn't anywhere around. I had no other support system there, and I had been isolated from my friends. I lost several friends during this whole ordeal. And just being able to call my best friend to pick me up after he had beat me up, that was one of the hardest things that I had to do. I basically had to eat crow and say, "You were right. Can I have you back in my life?" And thank God she was willing to accept me back into her life. And she was there for me and supported me 110%.
Mm-hmm. That's lucky. That's great. We often hear about economic issues in regard to why women stay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if a woman has been out of the job market for a number of years, who has never been in the job market, how does she negotiate? How does she navigate that?
Well, I think economic issues are very real, and we're obviously seeing the impact of that in this really hard economic times as well. I also want to reflect back on something that Christy said earlier, is that we also know that for women who are in a relationship with someone who's abusive, who are employed, their employment is often impacted. Statistically, at least 70% of abused women who are employed have been harassed at their job, and that can negatively impact their employment as well,
mm-hmm.
And their ability to make a living. And so I think that lack of economic resources can be a significant barrier, and that's also where an advocacy organization might be able to help connect people to resources, so that if that's the barrier, potentially staying at a shelter, getting assistance with that first month's rent, that there might be other options out there. And I do think that the question of why do people stay when there has been abuse. You know, in some ways, although it's a good question to ask because there are really significant barriers that we want to recognize, there are a lot of barriers.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, I like to rephrase the question to ask, what are those barriers that women are facing? Because I think when we can ask the question, well, why are people staying or why are women staying, we can somehow inadvertently start to shift that responsibility to the victim.
I understand what you're saying, yeah.
And the issue that's undermining safety for the victim is not the fact that they're unable to leave, that there are significant barriers to safety. And the issue is that their partner is continuing to abuse them. And the underlying question that I think we should be asking as a community is, why is that person continuing to do that? And why as a community are we also allowing that to continue to happen?
Mm-hmm.
But there are significant barriers facing survivors of domestic violence and a lot of reasons why it doesn't feel easy or possible or even safe to leave. You know, I think another important issue around that question is that leaving doesn't necessarily stop the abuse.
That's right.
Leaving can actually be a very dangerous time. And so I know a lot of survivors that I speak to talk about finding that right moment, about waiting for that time when it feels right, when all the ducks are lined up in a row and all the resources are in place, and that it feels like that right time. And that time may come right away, and that there may be a lapse of time.
Mm-hmm.
Before the survivor feels like, yep, this is it, I can go now. And that's where friends and family members become really important, of recognizing that it can take time and it can take resources and it can take support.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of people are starting to understand that you can't just go, I'm leaving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are often children, economic issues, self-esteem issues, where do you go?
Right, and fear.
And fear as
and
well,
fear
absolutely.
Is that the abusive partner has often made pretty specific threats about what will happen if you try to leave. And that fear is very real.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so being able to balance what are those safety needs and how do we help make the survivor as safe as possible while they are leaving. We know, unfortunately, that a high percentage of domestic violence homicides take place when the survivor is leaving or planning to leave.
Yeah.
And so what that means is that survivors need really concrete, specific support when they're leaving. And that's where the legal system can also be of assistance as well.
It's remarkable to me that it's only been since the late 60s, early 70s, during the second wave of the women's movement, that we've even become aware of this issue.
Yeah.
Because, you know, even when I was a kid, domestic violence was thought of as a private thing between a man and a woman, mm-hmm. and behind, you know, it's their privacy that we cannot trespass.
Yeah, when I get frustrated by how far we have to go and the things that we don't have in our community, I think it's helpful to remember that we've actually had a huge amount of social change
last
30, 40 years. We have created entire service structures, shelters, mm-hmm. and advocacy programs.
And not to mention changed laws.
And changed laws, but also we've seen a shift in attitudes.
Mm-hmm,
and I think
mm-hmm.
one of the places that we have seen a huge shift in is that notion that family violence is something private that we shouldn't talk about,
mm-hmm.
that there was this wall around the family.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened inside that wall was something that neighbors or friends or even the police shouldn't get involved in.
That's right.
And
yeah.
I think that's still there. It's still there, that hesitancy to get involved, but it's eroding. The fact that we're treating domestic violence as a crime is a huge social shift.
Oh, it is. And even treating rape as a crime.
Yes.
I remember when I was a kid, there was a T-shirt going around that said, in case of rape, this side up.
Mm.
Do you remember that?
I do.
That
yeah.
unbelievable how far we've come from thinking that these things were jokes.
Or even, for example, marital rape laws. That until the mid-80s, there was not possible to prosecute someone for rape if they were married to their victim. And
that's right.
I say
that's
that right. to young people now, and people think that's just completely ludicrous. How could that be? But I talked to women who were adults during that time, and that was absolutely the reality. So we definitely have made progress, but there's a lot of progress still to be
yeah,
made.
Yeah. How far have we come with law enforcement sensitivity?
I think we've come a long way. There's now training in a police academy. So all people who go through police academy are going to receive training on domestic violence. There's ongoing training. There's definitely been changes in laws. Like, for example, in New York State, there's mandatory arrest. And in many other states, there's mandatory arrest laws for domestic violence. But there's still a need for more training. That is definitely for sure. And so there needs to be, which also means there needs to be resources for training, which means that there are hours and dollars connected to that to make sure that law enforcement officers are getting really good, solid, ongoing training about how to respond most appropriately and sensitively to the needs of survivors.
Mm-hmm. And education in the community as well, because we've heard so many stories about women when the police finally arrive, refuse to press charges. And often that's because of fear, I'm sure.
It is. And also concern about, how will this help me? What will happen if this goes to court? What will that mean? And again, that's where an advocate can be helpful. We can help walk survivors through that process, explain to them what's going to happen. Here's what's going to happen next. But this is where changes in the law like mandatory arrest have made a difference. Because in New York State now, if the police respond to a domestic violence call and they have cause to believe that a felony has been committed, they need to make that arrest. That's what mandatory arrest laws say. So it takes away that discretion. The victim doesn't have to say, I want you to make the arrest.
Mm-hmm.
In misdemeanor level crimes, there's some law enforcement discretion. Now, this, like any other public policy change, it can sometimes be a double-edged sword. I've worked with survivors who have said, you know what, this was the most empowering thing that has happened. I didn't have to be the one to say, yes, I want him arrested.
Mm.
The police said, what happened to you was so serious, I'm filing the charges. I'm making the arrest.
Uh-huh.
That when friends or family called and said, what are you doing? Why are you pressing these charges? The victim was able to say, you know what, it wasn't me. I didn't file the charges. So it really provided a lot of support. I've also worked with survivors who said, you know what, I didn't want that to happen. I didn't want that arrest to happen. I don't think it helped me.
Mm.
I feel disempowered by this. So like any public policy approach, it's not going to always be one size fits all. But I think that the benefits outweigh some of the potential negative impacts
that we've
seen.
Oh, I would think so as well. I would think so as well. When people think of domestic violence, they often just think of heterosexual couples. How much violence is there in the gay and lesbian community? Is it the same percentage?
It is, and I think this was surprising when more research began to be done in the 90s on domestic violence and same-sex relationships, is that we think that violence happens in about the same proportion of relationships for gay and lesbian couples, so about 1 out of 3. So we know that this is an issue that hasn't been talked a lot about in the general community or in the LGBT community, and so it's we feel like it's really important that we're raising awareness both with service providers and professionals, but also in the general community, but that this is in the gay and lesbian community, we've got to be talking about healthy relationships and safety in relationships.
Mm-hmm. And do we still have a long way to go with law enforcement in regard to gay and lesbian relationships and violence?
There definitely needs to be increased training, I think, across the board for all professionals, including law enforcement, in homophobia and transphobia awareness, and how do we provide culturally competent services, and also screening for primary aggressor, making sure that we are properly assessing, regardless of whether it's a same-sex couple or a heterosexual couple, making sure that law enforcement have the training to do that appropriate screening to make sure that we're charging the person who is engaging in the violent behavior.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, we only have a couple minutes left. Christy, I wanted to ask you, what would you recommend to women who find themselves in violent relationships?
Definitely use your support networks, whether it's friends or family or peers, people that you work with, the advocacy centers. There's so much help out there to get out of the relationship, and you deserve so much more than what you are receiving. And I pray that all of you will recognize the goodness within yourselves to be able to be strong and get out of the relationship.
Mm-hmm. And what about you, Heather?
I think it's so important for people to know that if they're being abused, that it's not your fault, that what happened to you is not okay, and that there is support out there. And again, to reach out and to know that you're not alone. And also, if for people out there who are concerned about a friend or family member, to ask those questions, to ask, are you okay? I'm concerned about you. I want you to know that you're not alone. I think we need to feel more comfortable and feel more empowered to ask those questions and reach out to those people in our community and in our lives who we think may be experiencing violence.
And can you give any contact information for people both locally and nationally?
Absolutely. In Tompkins County, people can reach the Advocacy Center 24-hour hotline at 607-277-5000. And again, that number is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And nationally, people can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline. And that number is 1-800-799-SAFE. So 1-800-799-SAFE. That number is also available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They have counselors available who speak different languages, so there's great accessibility there. And that if you're wondering, I don't know where to call locally, you can always call the National Domestic Violence Hotline, and they'll be able to refer you to the best local resources.
Great. Well, thank you both so much for being with us. Heather Campbell, thank you so much for everything that you do. And Christy, good luck.
Thank you.
We are so proud of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.